Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all for our second day of oral argument in this new year. And we have some high school students with us today as part of our Caught with Class program. That's a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from across the state are invited to come to hear an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, they are sent materials about the case and may engage in some class activities related to the case. After this argument, they will meet with Justice Crooks of this court to discuss the procedures of the case, the procedures by which the court took the case and will decide the case. But we'll not discuss the substantive issues involved. Counsel, as well as everyone else in the courtroom, are welcome to join Justice Crooks and the students. Students will probably be joined by a high school group that came earlier today. If anyone in the courtroom would like a summary of the case, the marshal will hand it out. If you'd raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. Well, let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, with whom you'll meet right after this case. And to Justice Crooks's left is Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. On the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, seated next to her. Is she there? I'm sorry. That makes a very important point. You can see I do this by rote. Justice Ziegler is not participating in this case. That's why there's an empty seat. Ordinarily, Justice Ziegler is sitting there. So seated next to the empty seat is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Now I'm going to ask the students who are with us from Tenor High School to please stand. A faculty person can stand too. Thank you for coming and bringing your students, and thank you all for joining us today. You may be seated. I will now call our second case for today, 09-AP-538, Stephen T. Killian versus Mercedes-Benz USA and others. We have a lineup now of 15 minutes for Vincent Megna, 10 minutes for Timothy Aiken, and both are representing Stephen Killian, right? And Pat Wells has 30 minutes representing Mercedes-Benz et al. And Mr. Magnin, you'll be 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct? All right. Counsel?
Good morning, Justices. My name is Vince Megna. I'm with the law firm of Aiken and Skopter. Tim Aiken is also present, who will be sharing this argument with me, and we represent the petitioner, Stephen Killian. I would ask that my five-minute warning light go off at 10 minutes.
It will, counsel.
Thank you, Justice. Is rescission an equitable remedy? We maintain that it is. Wisconsin case law says it is. The Wisconsin lemon law allows a consumer under sub 7 to sue for equitable relief. The Court of Appeals in this case impliedly affirms that claim. The Court of Appeals addressed the issue of whether Killian had pled injunctive relief, and they said he didn't, which he did not plead injunctive relief. But Killian did plead in our pleadings. We pled equitable relief in the form of rescission of the lease. Instead, So the Court of Appeals missed the equitable relief in our complaint that we did plead. Instead, the court asked, what pecuniary loss did Killian suffer? The Court of Appeals said none. The trial court in this matter also looked hard and said there is no pecuniary loss, and therefore you cannot file this claim, and a summary judgment was issued against us in favor of Mercedes-Benz. But pecuniary loss is not required under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. And as an attorney, what should I have done when Steve Killian approached me and said, I've returned my vehicle to Mercedes-Benz, I've received my refund, but Mercedes-Benz Financial, the sister company of Mercedes-Benz, keeps contacting me saying I owe them money under the lease. They call me repeatedly, daily. They call my family. He comes to my office. What am I to do? Say, Mr. Killian, I know you don't owe the money, but our court system says you must have pecuniary loss. So what do you do? Just pay. Just pay. They say you owe them $5,000. They say you're 3 months delinquent. You have a $95,000 lease. You're a wealthy man. Just pay them the $1,700 a month.
Counsel, did you, at that time, did you review the consumer credit statute? And if so, why was that rejected as a vehicle, so to speak, to bring the claim?
The consumer credit.
Because it goes to kind of an overall theme in opposing counsel's argument that the Lemon Law was enacted to protect the rights of consumers in regard to the manufacturer of the automobile. And that function was carried out here when the Mercedes-Benz dealer took the car back. And then from the manufacturer's standpoint, it seems as if the argument goes, the purpose of the Lemon Law was fulfilled. But then in terms of the credit, the lender, that might have been more appropriate for a different avenue for pursuit.
Well, first of all, the lemon, that is one purpose of the Lemon Law, but that is not the only purpose of the Lemon Law. Another purpose is to put the consumer back to the position he was prior to entering into the lease. But even more importantly, the Lemon Law has four basic claims that can be brought. The sub B claim, which is the most common, where we seek a refund or replacement. The sub A claim, 2A, where we seek, where the manufacturer is required to repair the vehicle within the first year, and if they don't, you can file a claim. But there's two other claims. One is under 2D, which prohibits anyone at any person from selling a vehicle that has been returned to the manufacturer as a lemon. It prohibits anyone from selling that vehicle without disclosing full disclosure of why it was returned. So there would be a violation under that section if a dealer sold a lemon but didn't disclose to the person that it was a lemon and why it was a lemon. And we could file a lawsuit, and we have filed lawsuits against dealers for that violation. The fourth violation is the prohibition against enforcement of the lease, which we have here. It's a Lemon Law right, a Lemon Law that can be violated by a lessor, as it was done in the Killian case. They violated a specific section of the Lemon Law, and we filed a lawsuit under that. But after we had attempted to get them to stop enforcement of the lease, Killian tried over and over. He went to the dealership and invoked their help. And we tried. We wrote three letters. And we even got an apology from Mercedes-Benz and said, okay, we're going to stop. But lo and behold, 10 days later, they send a federal legal notice saying that we're going to submit this to the credit bureau. And the next day, they send a statement saying you're $5,400 in delinquents. So if you're referring to the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that's an act that's out there, but we have a strict violation of the Lemon Law, the Wisconsin Lemon Law, and we chose to file suit to pursue that claim that was given to us with the enactment of the Lemon Law. And it goes beyond the main purpose of the Lemon Law in putting a consumer back to the position they were in before the deal, and also the purpose of getting a manufacturer to buy back the vehicle, because the Lemon Law speaks to two other instances other than just buying back the vehicle in order to meet the purpose of the Lemon Law, and this is just one of them, so we chose to do that.
Well, do you have a cause of action under the Consumer Credit Act? And if you would not succeed here, can you just bring another case under the Credit Act?
Are you talking of the Fair Debt Collection Act?
Any of the credit acts.
Under the Fair Debt Collection Act, we don't have a claim because Mercedes-Benz sent the letters. They sent the notices. They dealt with them. And Mercedes-Benz is not considered a debt collector under the Fair Debt Collection Act.
What about financial services?
I mean, financial is not considered a debt collector. They are the creditor. The Fair Debt Collection Act refers, it prohibits debt collectors from doing certain
things.
They're
not a debt collector.
They're not a debt collector at all under the definition. So there is absolutely no claim there.
So if you don't get any relief here, this victim of the Lemon Law does not get relief from the expenses to put a stop to financial services not following the statute.
Correct. Correct.
Is that your position?
Pardon?
Is that your position?
Yes. Under the Fair Debt Collection Act. So we pursued it because it was a Lemon Law violation. And the statutes clearly says we can sue for any damages. We can sue for equitable relief when there is a violation of the Lemon Law. This was a violation of the Lemon Law because we read the entire Lemon Law, all seven sections, as one. We read it together. We don't separate it out. Certainly there are other violations of the Lemon Law, being the failure to repair a vehicle. That's not the case here. And the other violation, as I said, was selling a lemon without disclosing. That would have nothing to do with the manufacturer, or potentially, in many cases, nothing to do with the manufacturer, because a dealer doesn't disclose.
You know, I have trouble deciding whether you won or you've lost this case. Won the case in that you got financial off your back.
Yes.
And Mercedes. All of them agree you're absolutely right. Your client is right on. No, you don't owe them a dime, and they got to stop saying you do, and they can't do anything to harm you. You won that, right?
Eventually.
And that's what you wanted. I mean, that's why you were in court. Right.
That's why we filed the suit, yes.
Right. And you tried to do it without filing a suit, and it took several months, and they finally conceded, right?
Yes, okay. Your Honor.
Then, one other aspect of that case is, do you collect damages? Do you get any money from them, other than the typical costs that you get if you win a lawsuit, right?
That and plus okay. Attorney's fees.
And that is, I don't want to use the word ancillary, but it is ancillary to the main event, which is stop harassing me.
Yes.
Right? And that you lost, right?
We did lose it at the trial court, yes.
And at the Court of Appeals.
And at the Court of Appeals.
Right. So you lost that. Did you get, so, and you get, got no cost, the standard cost? Did you get
we had to pay costs.
You had to pay costs. So you won the major event of the substance. You lost a motion, in effect, or part of your complaint on damages, and then you had to pay costs.
We had to pay costs.
So did you win or lose that lawsuit?
Well, in as far as Killian was concerned, it's both. We won because this was a very damaging thing that was going on, and it stopped. It stopped after the lawsuit was filed, even though when we filed the complaint in the defendant's answers, they denied that they were violating the law. They even denied, financial denied in the complaint that they even sent out the federal notice. So, but then the lease was paid off about 2 months after we filed the lawsuit.
This was really Mercedes' fault too, because if they had, if Mercedes and Financial had gotten together, right?
Yes.
Then the title would have passed, the debt would have been wiped out, and that the statute, as I understand it, and you better correct me if I'm wrong, is not so clear as to how Mercedes deals with Financial. Who has to take the first step and when to clean up the mess?
It is not clear, and the decision in Tammy by this court further confuses things. For 20 years, it has operated like this. In a lease situation, you make your demand to the manufacturer to buy it back, and the manufacturer, if they accept, they accept, take the vehicle back, pay the consumer's refund, and then pay off the lease. That was the landscape for almost 20 years that I practiced under, and so did the defense counsels, all of the defense counsels. This was the understanding. And there was a case called Varda, which seemed to say that. They said to get a refund, there's three elements. One is return the car, get your refund, and the manufacturer pays off the lease. But the Tammy question changes that. And Tammy now says, as far as I understand, it says the consumer must make a demand in a lease situation to get the consumer's refund from the manufacturer. But if the lessor wants a refund, they have to make a demand. In other words, under a Lemon Law case now, the lessor doesn't even have to ask for a refund. There's no requirement that they get a refund. So the lessor, under this holding, the lessor can actually keep the vehicle, say, we don't want to surrender it. We're going to keep it. That's there's reasons why they'd want to keep it, which I probably don't have time to go into, but there's reasons they might want to keep it. But now, since the Tammy decision, The demand made by the consumer will only get the consumer's refund. In order for the lease to be paid off and actually the vehicle taken off the road, the lessor is going to have to make a demand for a refund.
So it's clear that this lease is not enforceable under the statutes. I mean, that's clear. You get to that stage in terms between the manufacturer and the lessor, to me, was not clear. And I don't know that you've made it any clearer, I'm afraid.
I think that's true. It is not clear now. A case came in just last week, the same situation, and I explained to the person, we're going to make a demand on the manufacturer. That isn't going to guarantee that the lease is going to be paid off, and we're going to have to deal with that when we get to it. The red light is on, and Attorney Aiken is going to...
Thank you,
over.
Mr. Magner. Timothy J. Aiken, also representing Stephen Killian.
I want to primarily deal with two issues. One is the part of the case we lost and the questions about the Collection and Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I have unfortunately, some experience in. As Attorney Magnus said, there's no question that the Collection Act doesn't apply here because we don't have a collection company.
Now, are we talking about 427?
No, I was talking about the federal statute.
You're talking about the federal, but what about the state statute? But you can get to that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr.
I'm not going to discuss the Collection Act because Mr. Magna handled that. But
okay, and you agree with him?
Yes.
They're not covered under that?
Yeah,
okay.
They're not covered because they're not a collection agency.
All right.
Now, let's talk about the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Okay.
The problem with that is the solution is built into that act is at least a delay of 45 days. That's just about a given. It's could be read as 30, but in practice it's at least 45. And all that happens, the consumer has to write. So that's, let's say, 3 days. And the only person that they truly are supposed to communicate with is the credit bureau. They can copy what they call the furnisher, which in this case would be financial, the one who reports these debts. Then the credit reporting agency has 5 days or so to send it to financial, and then they wait for financial's reply. They call it a reinvestigation because supposedly when this debt was posted, there was an investigation done by the furnisher. But this is really the first investigation, which is really a pseudo-investigation because all that happens is the furnisher reviews their records, which we know in this case showed that there was an outstanding lease and a debt, and indeed that it was behind in payment. The furnisher then responds to the credit bureau and says, everything's still valid that we've shown you. The credit bureau then responds to the consumer and says, we don't find any error here. Then the consumer has to put together a packet information showing how this is all wrong. And they put that together and they resubmit it to the credit bureau, who then resubmits it to the furnisher, and the furnisher goes about the process of determining whether or not the debt should be removed or not. This can take a process of, in my experience, a minimum of 90 days, and I have one case where it's taken about a year on a debt that was clearly paid off. In the meantime, now Mr. Killian is a wealthy man, but leases are entered into for Chevy Chevettes and Ford Escorts, $300 a month leases. What does the consumer do to get the next car after he's turned his car into the manufacturer with this lease on his record? The average consumer can't take 90 days or 180 days or more to get the lease cleared from his record. And it's going to be there. Even if it isn't marked as unpaid, it's still going to be showing a lease. Worse here, though, is that it was reported as behind in payment. So as a result, the consumer is double stuck. How does that consumer get a new car, the car to replace the car they just got? It won't happen. And the Fair Credit Reporting Act isn't meant to help it happen. We submitted materials. It's a long process to get this cleared up.
You know, I'm assuming you're telling us this to show you're damaged. Is my assumption wrong?
To show that we need to be able to protect the consumer right away.
Under this statute.
Under the lemon law.
Lemon law.
Yes.
And to comply with section 218.01717, you're going to have to show damages.
No, it helps if we can show damages, but I read the statute as if we're suing for equitable relief, we get attorney fees.
All right. I'll restate it. The reason you're telling us this is because you think you qualify under this subsection 7 for damages. However you do it, you have been harmed and maybe should get equitable relief, right?
We should get equitable relief. We should get attorney fees for enforcing the statute. And in this case, we believe we're damaged because the financial admitted that they not only threatened to collect, but they reported us to the reporting agencies.
Okay, a couple of things. What does equitable relief mean?
Rescission.
All right.
That's the equitable relief that was stated in the complaint. One could have sued for injunction, but I think rescission was the more appropriate remedy.
Does it equitable mean fair, or do you mean equity rescission?
There's really three types of rescission. There's the most of the texts talk about rescission that's agreed to by the parties, which kind of is what happened after about 60 days. That's the typical rescission, but that's a type of equitable rescission. This was an equitable rescission because we weren't seeking, we weren't affirming the contract. We're disaffirming.
All right.
Okay? So that, and legal rescission is a pretty rare animal.
Really asking you, what does equitable mean? Does it mean fair or does it mean a remedy in equity?
I believe it's a remedy in equity because the statute refers to any other equitable relief. I'm assuming the legislature meant the term as we would use it, which would be courts in equity.
Then you're eating both. So, okay, rescission is equitable.
Yes, ma'am.
Injunction might have been, others might have been that. So you claim that, you therefore think you fall under damages, even though you don't show any pecuniary damages.
Well, there's two questions there. One is I don't think we need to show damages, but let's talk about the damages. The defense maintains that we have to show a loss of business, trade, or profession. The court has been clear way back to the outboard marine case in 15 Wisconsin 2nd, which we cite, but was approved in other cases since. Libel, that is written publication, if it has a defamatory meaning, we need show no damages. This five-step criteria applied in slander per se does not apply to libel. This is a written communication. We attach the written communication, some of it to our complaint, and then we got the next document we attached to Mr. Killian's affidavit. But they clearly communicated a matter that mars the person's credit. In this court, in the Denny case, said if it's defamatory if it attempts to so harm the reputation of another as to lower him in the estimation of the community or to deter third persons from associating or dealing with him. When one gets a bad report on their credit rating, that doesn't just affect your credit. It affects how much you pay for credit. It also, believe it or not, affects your ability to get life insurance, health insurance, disability insurance. I don't know why. The treatises are clear. And the worst part is oftentimes the consumer doesn't even know that these people that are getting these credit reports are getting, he has a marred credit. And it's all done on the basis of a credit score. So if you, for example, if you could pay your mortgage every single month of your life, you could pay five mortgages, which is oftentimes worse. Your score goes down if you have too many mortgages. But if you get a bad credit report from a company like a physician who you haven't paid because you're waiting for the insurance company, or here, a leasehold carrier, you drop below 620 points, you're not getting credit. You're not getting credit as a typical consumer. And even a wealthy person has trouble getting credit. So this is more than just a little incidental when these companies just automatically report as Financial did here. It's not an...
Mr. Aiken.
Yes?
If I understand your opponent's argument, one, Mercedes doesn't think your client should be in court at all because the whole point of this statute was to protect the lessor and the consumer against the manufacturer, because that's the heavy there. You disagree with that, right?
Yes, because otherwise we wouldn't need the statute that said no lease can be enforced.
Okay. Yes, the other point, and big point, as I read their briefs, is you don't show damages. Is defamation your strongest suit?
For damages?
For damages.
If we need to show damages, it's my opinion defamation is our strongest, and the question is whether or not pre-suit attorney fees, which in Lemon Law are normally part of the attorney fee collection when you win,
right,
if whether or not those are damages because of the duty of good faith owed between the Financial and us.
And that's why you cite DeShant, which is
yes,
is the insurance bad faith
yes
case. Okay. Assume, for the purpose of argument, that the court agrees with you that you can sue and agrees with you that you have defamation as a potential damage. This is a summary judgment case. What are the issues of material fact in this case? You say they reported your client was in default. That's what you say. They say, hey, you don't have proof of that. You've got somebody who says, well, there's a possibility. What do you answer to that?
He said much more than that. He said possibility, meaning when it occurred, but it's a probability, and we showed that, and his testimony is clear, and it's attached to Mr. Magna's affidavit. Did you, in all probability, file with the credit reporting agency? Yes. And I can assure you that they're supposed to file, unless they have reason to know that it's not true, they're supposed to file under the Credit Reporting Act like in 45 days after a debt is due. And he even says 30, 60, 90. We're way beyond 90 days before they withdraw this lease.
You didn't show here that there was credit damage. You didn't show he tried to get credit and was stopped from getting credit. You didn't show any of that.
Right, and we don't have to. Right. That's the point, and that's why their brief was wrong when they said we had to show damage. That's the whole idea with libel.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bacon,
I'm sorry. Justice Prosser.
Could I ask you, did the decision in the Tammy case make your situation more difficult, or did it change your situation in any way?
It changed it and made it more difficult in that it was always thought that the manufacturer had to pay off the lessor. If they didn't do that within 30 days, just like the manufacturer has to pay off the bank debt, if they don't do that in 30 days, we have a Lemon Law violation, and therefore we can file our suit for double damages. The Tammy case, implicitly anyway, said that, no, the manufacturer doesn't have to pay off the lessor. And as a result, when we sought damages to begin with, we were seeking them under the Varda case. And the Tammy case came down, and it was rather clear that the lower courts, anyway, were going to say, I guess the lessor has to submit its own Lemon Law claim, which really left, to a large degree, the lessee, the consumer, in unattended, because it was never said, what are we going to do about this lessee now? And in this situation, it shows that when you have these big financial companies, even though they're sister companies between Mercedes, one arm is saying, well, yeah, we're going to investigate, and the other arm is reporting them. What happened with the change of the Tammy case compared to Varda is this would have all been cleared up. There would have been a total and united settlement. We still have the problem, if I may, that what happens when they don't report to the credit reporting agency, and let's say they don't even try to collect it, but there's no satisfaction given. Maybe the lessor doesn't want to get the car back. I mean, wants to keep the car. Or maybe the lessor just doesn't get around to it. What does the consumer do with the lease that's outstanding? I mean, regardless if the lessor does something wrong like they did here, it's still a problem. We need to have a satisfaction issued if the lessor makes a decision not to pursue the Lemon Law claim, which, of course, they could have done, because once the car's turned in, it's a slam dunk for the lessor.
Help me once more. When the automobile is returned to the manufacturer, is the lease not inoperative?
It is according to statute, but what makes it inoperative? What gives the consumer either a piece of paper or something to say to the next dealer, now I want to buy a replacement car? Well, no, you have a lease here. Well, yeah, but I turned that car in. Well, you still have a lease. The consumer needs, even in the best situation, they need a satisfaction of lease to be secured upon returning the vehicle so the lessor can do what they want. And before Tammy, that wasn't necessary. The manufacturer was forced before Tammy to go to the lessor and say, give us how much your payoff is on your lease, just like occurs in a purchase situation. That's what the manufacturer has to do. They have to go to U.S. Bank and say, how much is the payoff on this debt for this car? And they have to pay both within the 30 days, or they violate the Lemon Law. That's been lost. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Mr. Wells.
Still before noon, so good morning, Justices. My name is Patrick Wells. I represent, in this case, Daimler Chrysler Financial Services Americas LLC, who we've now been referring to as Mercedes-Benz Financial. I think the court's got it right now. There are some questions that were a little confusing earlier, whether Mercedes-Benz was here. Mercedes-Benz is not here. All the claims have been dismissed.
That's right. Now it hasn't been appealed, but it's the financial. Right?
That's correct. From the court's questions. What I think I'd like to do, earlier I thought this as well, I see that there's three issues in this case. And the first is really whether or not we should be suing a lessor under the Lemon Law. And then as part of that, can you, even if you can sue a lessor under the Lemon Law, is there any basis for the recovery of attorney fees when the consumer doesn't prevail on any claim for damages? And then the collateral issues are the second issues that were argued by the petitioner. And I consider them collateral because what I think the petitioner is trying to argue is that, well, I've got an easier chance on the first issue because I can show damages. And the first way I can do that is by showing attorney fees or damages. And the second way is I can show I've got defamation damages. And if I can convince the court that those damages claims are not valid, then we're really talking about what you described as the big issue, and that is, are we suing lessors under the Lemon Law? Was that the purpose of the statute? And even if we can we award a plaintiff who does not prevail under that attorney's fees? The first issue with
counsel, could you just briefly state the facts here and explain why the other side doesn't have a legitimate grievance here, and what are they supposed to do about it?
I think if you look at Judge Ramirez's decision, and the trial court sits in, I think, the best position to analyze the facts of this case. And certainly the petitioner and respondent have different versions or have espoused different versions of the facts in this case. Mr. Killian makes a demand upon the manufacturer, says, I want a refund of the Lemon Law. The manufacturer responds and says, yes, we're going to do this. There is a short window of opportunity. There's 30 days for the manufacturer to accomplish this. If there's delays in mailing, getting in contact with a local representative, an attorney, that could shorten even further. And so in this case, that is done in that short time frame. And granted, as Mr. Magna says, typically what happens is the leasing company or the bank is involved and they get a payoff statement and those sorts of things. But it didn't happen in this case.
Who gets a payoff notice?
Well, typically both sides are going to want to know what is the balance owed on a lease or in a financing situation, what is owed on a loan. But with a lease, it's easier to calculate what the refund is going to be because it is the down payment and the payments made to date. And so in this case, that refund was given to Mr. Killian. He returned the vehicle to the manufacturer under the Lemon Law.
Then what was supposed to happen?
What was supposed to happen, the law doesn't say what's supposed to happen.
That's the problem. Okay.
Typically, the manufacturer will contact the leasing company and say, we're doing this. I need a payoff statement. It's understood that they probably want their refund. They don't have to, but they probably will either way.
They, as the manufacturer, wants the refund.
The leasing company.
The leasing company. I'm sorry.
The lessor.
The lessor.
The refund.
Likewise, the consumer's representative attorney oftentimes, or almost always, as I've seen it, contacts the leasing company, the lessor, or the financing company, and alerts them to the fact that this is happening. In this case, it didn't happen.
How much is owed on that lease?
On the lease at the time, it was about roughly $95,000.
Okay. So that should have been paid to the lessor.
If the lessor demands a refund. As Mr. Magna acknowledges, and I think Mr. Aiken did as well, there's two refund procedures in a leasing situation, one to the lessee and one to the lessor. The lessor has the option of getting a refund or not getting a refund, and they can keep the car.
In this case, what is the relationship between the manufacturer and the lessor? What is the exact, precise legal relationship between the two?
That fact is not in the record, and although I could speculate to it, I don't want
to
speculate.
If it is not in the record, then?
They are related entities, but to the exact nature, I couldn't speak to that, and it was never part of the record.
Okay. Justice Prosser.
Would it be fair to say that Mr. Killian did nothing wrong here?
Yes, I believe that would be fair to say. I would think it would be also fair to say that Mercedes-Benz didn't do anything wrong here. And getting back to the question about the facts, I think it's also fair to say that, and as Judge Ramirez said in the trial court, after he examined all the facts, and he says, I've reviewed the pleadings, the affidavits, the depositions, and I come down to the belief that this was simply a mistake. You know, Mercedes Financial wasn't alerted to the fact that this transaction had occurred. They don't have any sort of copy of a check that showed the refund was given to the consumer. As is their normal practice, they contact their lessee and then for the purpose of finding out, hey, you missed a payment. Is there something wrong? Is there something that we should know about? You're late on a payment. Then there's a letter as exchanged. Mr. Megan sent a letter on to Mercedes Financial, and it was responded to by a manager at Mercedes Financial who said, we apologize for any inconvenience and frustration as a result of prior phone calls, as this was certainly not our intent. Should you need additional assistance, please feel free to contact me directly, and he provided him with a direct telephone number. Okay. Automated statements, unfortunately, went out after that.
It seems to me you've got a manufacturer. They want to sell cars. The lessee often doesn't have the money to pay. They have to borrow money. So there is a close relationship between the manufacturer and the lessor. They work together. Money is made by both sides when they work together. And it seems to me when the underlying deal goes sour, these two major entities have to work together. And you can't, their failure to work together cannot cause injury to the lessee or the purchaser. And if it does, you got to give the purchaser some remedy, don't you?
Well, the question, I guess it poses two questions. One, was this purchaser actually damaged? And two, what remedies are available to this purchaser? There's nothing alleged in this case that Mercedes-Benz did something wrong. The only thing that's alleged in this case is that Mercedes Financial made some telephone calls inquiring as of the status when they missed a payment, and then received some automated statements after Mr. Killing's attorney sent a letter. That is the sum total of what happened in this case, despite contentions otherwise. And that's why I think Judge Ramirez says, I don't see that anything was done here other than a simple mistake that was apologized for, and I don't see any reason why there had to be a lawsuit brought here.
Well, I'm sorry. Justice Prosser?
Oh, sorry.
Well, isn't your position that if there is harm to Mr. Gillian, that he ought to sue in a different cause of action? If he's been defamed, that's a personal injury lawsuit. There are cases that say no personal injury under Lemon Law. He has personal injury, you sue under another law. Isn't that your position?
That is absolutely our position.
As I read your brief, your position is you, the lessor, cannot be sued under the Lemon Law for trying to enforce the lease, even though under the Lemon Law it is an unenforceable lease. Now, I've stated it starkly, but isn't that your position?
Yes, our position is that the Lemon Law tells the lessor, in effect, as soon as this consumer receives a refund, a Lemon Law refund from a manufacturer, that lease is unenforceable. You need to look somewhere else. Okay. You can send in your own notice to the manufacturer and get a refund. Or you can simply keep the car, and for example, if it has been driven no miles and it somehow is worth more than the current value of the written lease, you can attempt to sell it on the market as long as you brand the title and those sorts of things. If you think you can get...
Put Lemon across the back of it.
Right. It just is a message to the lessor that you must look elsewhere. This lease is terminated. You can't enforce it against the consumer.
That's your basic argument. Then if I understand it, your subsidiary argument is, okay, if you lose that, there aren't damages here under sub 7. Isn't that your argument?
That's true. I think and that's the way we laid it out in the brief. It's sort of a flow chart, if you will. You know,
right.
If you answer no, stop. If you answer
right.
Yes, you continue.
Right.
If you can sue a leasing company, which we say you can't under the Lemon Law, that's not the purpose of it, then you stop. If this court says you can sue under this, then we get to the question, can you sue under the Lemon Law? Did the legislature intend, just because it has some, you know, some tangential relationship to a lemon vehicle, does that authorize a consumer to come in and bring a tort claim under the Lemon Law and suddenly double the tort damages and recover attorney fees?
Well,
only
you don't double equitable damages and you don't double attorney fees. You only double pecuniary. Isn't that right?
That's correct, but I don't know that equitable...
I don't know how you calculate
damages
that.
And, you know, other monetary damages and equity.
Just one other question. In CUELLAR, however that's pronounced, versus Ford Motor, which is a Court of Appeals decision, it's not directly on point. It is an absolutely nearly identical statute. The only difference is a parenthetical in there, 218.01724. And I read that case. The court said there just the opposite of what the court says here as to how to interpret exactly the same language. How do you explain that?
I agree.
Conflicting cases.
I think the Cuellar case can
Cuellar?
Be
okay.
Can be read, and I too find the decision, the phrase, and it's a short section of the decision that seems to imply that a consumer does not have to show pecuniary loss to sue under a similar statute.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the same time, the court remanded the case to the trial court for determination as to whether or not the consumers in that case actually did sustain a pecuniary loss.
Yeah, I saw that, too.
So with those two different statements, I have a hard time...
The law is they're entitled to it. Go back to the trial court and prove up your case. I mean, I don't find them conflicting. I mean, I thought I did have a kind of a little surprise ending in that case when I saw that, but not shocked. Just a little surprise. So I understand your point on that. But you do have a conflict.
Yes. I mean, in order, our theory, if the court, if the decision in Cuellar is read literally, that phrase that says they can sue under a similar statute without pecuniary loss, it would contradict the position that we are taking, that a literal reading of the plain language of the statute is that a consumer can only bring an action for damages. The same language appears in both of those sections. It says a consumer who is a consumer may bring an action for damages as a result of violation of this section. That is the only authorizing phrase in the statute. Only then, a consumer who prevails in such action, i.e., an action for damages, can then obtain equitable relief and attorney's fees and costs.
Justice Bradley.
Help me with these statutes. I can't even figure out the exact number, but it is in 218.01.71, which deals with repair, replacement, and refund under new motor vehicle warranties. That's 218.0171. And what I'm focusing on is, boy, in this interpretation of the statutory scheme, it makes no sense to me that the manufacturer doesn't have to pay off the lessor. That's one of the problems that's going on here, and Justice Prosser was focusing on that. And I look at the language under, looks like sub 2, around sub B, 2B. And it says that the manufacturer, as I understand it, shall accept return of the motor vehicle and refund to the consumer and to any holder of a perfected security interest in the consumer's motor vehicle, as the interest may appear, the full purchase price plus, you know, finance charges and stuff. Then in the next paragraph in sub 3, with respect to a consumer, I'm going to say described above, the manufacturer, I'm adding, shall accept return of the motor vehicle, refund to the motor vehicle lessor, and to any holder of a perfected security interest in the motor vehicle, as their interest may appear, the current value of the written lease, and refund to the consumer the amount the consumer paid under the written release, So what am I missing? Boy, that language looks to me like it's the responsibility of the manufacturer to notify the lessor and to pay off.
And this was argued at the Court of Appeals level and at the trial court level at some length. It was our position that beginning with, I think, the Riley versus Ford Motor Company case that says the current value of the written lease is not an element of the consumer's damages, but clarified in actually this court's decision in Tammy, is if you look below that under sub CM, okay.
Yes.
Justice Bradley, the section that you just read from tells us how to calculate who gets the portions of the refund and when to provide them. But if we look down to CM, they have to be read together. And sub CM tells us how these refunds are actually provided. And under sub CM 1, it says to receive a refund due under paragraph B3, a consumer described under sub 1, sub B, sub 4, and that's a lessee consumer, demands a refund and the manufacturer provides it within 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
If you look below in sub 2, this tells the lessor how the lessor is to receive its refund. Okay? So if you look at sub 1 and sub 2, for example, under sub CM sub 1, when the consumer demands the refund, the manufacturer provides the consumer's refund within 30 days.
Yes.
And I think it has to be that way that the manufacturer doesn't have a statement from the leasing company as to what is owed.
Well, let's say the leasing company, and that's the problem here. That's the one where the consumer is swinging in the wind. Let's say the lessor under sub 2 that you were just reading doesn't want a payoff from the manufacturer, has no economic incentive to get a payoff from the manufacturer. Where does that leave the consumer?
That's why we read sub 3 very literally, there's a section which renders the lease unenforceable, the one that we've been talking about. It says after a consumer receives a refund from the manufacturer under the section, the lease is no person may enforce the lease thereafter. And that's why if you read all of these sections together, that's why you have separate refund procedures. The consumer may ask for a refund and get it. The lessor may say, I don't want one.
And so then the consumer, the way that you're reading it, the consumer has to initiate an action because under the sub 3 that you were just referring to, no person may enforce the lease against the consumer after a consumer received a refund. But because there's no connect between the manufacturer and the leaseor, no communication, in order to enforce his right or her right under sub 3, the consumer is going to have to, arguably as done here, start a lawsuit against the lessor in order to stop enforcement of the lease.
I don't know what forms enforcement could take. And here that brings
up... Say that first part again, I'm sorry.
I don't know what forms enforcement can take. And it brings up an interesting issue in this case is we have some phone calls. Okay, what is enforcement? You know, and it's a problem if the court is going to interpret the statute to provide a claim for enforcement. What does that mean?
Well, are you asserting you didn't enforce this lease? You billed them for $5,000?
They never paid anything.
I know, but is that your defense here under 3? Because it's not, I didn't read it in your briefs, so I want to know if that's your defense. No person may enforce the lease. Are you saying financial did not enforce the lease?
Brings up a question of interpretation of the statutes. What does it mean to enforce the lease?
Well, one thing, I think if the lessor says you owe me, pay me, says it once, sends a bill, threatens to report me to credit bureaus. You don't think that's enforcing?
Is it done intentionally or accidental? You know, I mean, that's kind of what...
Look, it doesn't say may enforce it negligently, may not enforce it negligently, may not enforce it intentionally. I mean, you're not going to say financial is negligent, are you, and that doesn't know what it's doing.
I don't believe Financial was negligent at all. In fact, I think that's why Judge Ramirez says they were in the dark. They didn't know what was happening, and they just called by a mistake.
Let me just stress Justice Bradley's point. Her point is that the only remedy that under this statute is, I shouldn't say only remedy under the statute, the only remedy to protect the consumer here against collection techniques by Financial is to sue them.
Yes.
That's right.
And then once they sue them, and then Financial stops and hires an attorney, you know, I'm talking about the ordinary consumer. You know, once they have to hire an attorney to sue Financial, and then Financial says, well, I don't know what's fine. Okay, you know, we're not going to continue pursuing enforcement. Then they're no longer the prevailing party because they prevailed in litigation, right? They got the relief they would want. Financial stopped trying to enforce this lease. Why wouldn't they be the prevailing party in litigation? Because that's what you did. You stopped enforcing the lease.
In this case, there was no, as I see, there was no demand for that relief sought. If you look at the complaint, it demands monetary damages, and the big ticket item for a long time before it was abandoned was that the plaintiff demanded $230,000 from Mercedes-Benz USA.
Didn't they want you to concede that they didn't owe you any money?
I believe that's a fair reading of at least what they probably wanted, but it's not demanded in the complaint.
Well, what was demanded in the complaint?
They demanded monetary damages, and they demanded rescission of the complaint. Rescission of the lease.
Yeah, so that means stop demanding enforcement. It's null and void, and you can't enforce it. So stop it.
That's right. And you conceded, your client conceded, you have to stop. Your client conceded they don't owe you $5,000+ or any other amount, right?
Correct. I believe a fair reading, though, however, of the facts in the case is that Financial conceded before the lawsuit was filed. And I think that part of Judge Ramirez's problem with was there a need to file this lawsuit is that he concluded that based on his review of the facts, there was no need for the lawsuit, that Financial acknowledged this was our mistake. We were in the dark on this. We didn't understand this. If something else comes up in the meantime, please call me. Here's my telephone number.
You know, that may be true, but it took you at least 2 months to concede in court, isn't it? It was sued in, what, June or July? No formal admission until, what, August? It wasn't a return mail.
In August is when the refund transaction took place between Mercedes-Benz and Mercedes-Benz Financial.
When was the lawsuit filed?
My recollection, middle of July.
When did you dun them for $5,000?
There was an automated notice generated, I believe, a week or two after Mr. Beeler from Mercedes Financial wrote back to Mr. Megna and apologized and provided his phone number. In his deposition, he's asked about the automated notices. He says, to my knowledge, at that time frame, there was no way that we could have stopped the computer from generating that notice, that it was not necessarily a reaffirmation on their part that they thought that money was owed by Mr. Killian.
On May 7th, Killian returned the vehicle to Mercedes, right? After Killian, this is the facts in the blue brief. If they're wrong, I'm relying on the brief. After Killian returned the vehicle to Mercedes, Killian began receiving telephone calls including daily, demanding payment. The lease, if I understand this, became unenforceable as soon as Killian returned the vehicle and got a check. Is that right?
Correct. I would interpret it the same way.
So that was May. Then there was conversations, and there was, according to the blue brief, there were numerous attempts to resolve the matter short of litigation. You may disagree with that, but then anyway, that was, so it was returned in May, and the Mercedes gave him a check. In mid-June, Killian retained counsel. Counsel began again letters in June of 2007. Is that right? Then we got a legal notice, right? And when was the suit filed? October 2007, right?
July 10th is the date of signature on the complaint of same day of filing.
Of what year?
2007.
Okay. All right. And when did you concede? October 1? I'm at the bottom of page 4. October 1? You conceded after the complaint was filed? July 10th to October 1.
I guess I'm troubled. I'm not sure what the court deems conceding that the lease is not owed. I would interpret the June 20, 2007 letter from Glenn Beeler as acknowledging that he's not entitled to enforce the lease against Mr. Killian, and that the automated statement that went out was a computer-generated notice that he was unable to stop, and that Judge Ramirez deemed a mistake. As soon as the refund check was, copies were in my hands, copies were provided to counsel, and they were asked to dismiss the suit. And, of course, from then on, it was a year and a half litigation over whether Mercedes-Benz owed them $230,000. I think that was really what was driving this all along, is their argument that Mercedes-Benz had to issue a refund to the lessor within the same 30-day time frame, and that the consumer could thereafter, if it wasn't done within 30 days, could make a demand for the current value of the written lease.
So what I hear you telling us is they shouldn't have sued. You were complying anyway, and any damages for their hiring a lawyer to get you to do anything, it's not your fault, it's their fault.
No, I think the position more concisely is as soon as Mr. Killian received his refund, the lease became unenforceable. If Mercedes Financial thereafter ignores that and commits some tort, the consumer has a number of different remedies under the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Are you a collection agency under the Wisconsin statutes?
I don't know that. I think I agree that it's not under the collection, but under the Fair Credit Reporting Act there may be a claim.
Federal.
If they really felt that there was a dispute, there could have been an action for declaratory judgment. But I think with the June 20, 2007 letter from Glenn Beeler, it's clear that there was no justiciable dispute. So there would be no declaratory judgment lying. If they were really harassing them, they could have brought an action for injunctive relief and a restraining order. That was not done. If there was really a defamation occurring here, there could have been a separate lawsuit brought in tort. I don't believe that the Lemon Law was intended to supplant the common law of defamation and allow them to recover double their defamation damages and attorney's fees simply because it is somewhat related to a car. So there are a number of different remedies available to them. The whole question is, and this is really what's driving it, is we want the Lemon Law because we can get our attorney's fees. Even though we don't really have damages, pre-suit of fees have never been deemed damages, and I think the insurance case is completely inapplicable here, because the only reason attorney's fees are recoverable in an insurance dispute like that is because the consumer loses the benefit of the bargain, that being the defense costs paid in defense of another third-party suit. In other words, those are consequential damages. Those aren't attorney's fees directly as a result of third-party litigation as deemed as damages. And so really that's, I think that's what's driving everything, is can we sort of put this square peg, which is a tort claim, into the round hole of the Lemon Law so we can recover attorney's fees. And I don't think that that was the purpose of this law, to allow a claim under these circumstances that against lessors who are regarded likewise as consumers under the statute.
Chief, if I...
Justice Bradley.
Help me with this. I want to separate out the defamation. I want to just forget it right now. If they sued you to stop, or if a party sues you to stop enforcement of your collecting under the lease because the lease is no longer valid, and 2 months later you stop, why aren't they the prevailing party? Why didn't they win something?
So we are getting past at least the first issue, assuming that you can bring a claim against a lessor, that this claim lies here, and sort of ignoring what are the elements of this claim, does the intent need to be shown, all those other things, why should they not be regarded as the prevailing party under these circumstances?
Failed in litigation, if their desire is that they stop you from collecting on this lease.
It's a very good question. And there is a whole body of law out there on what does it mean to be a prevailing party.
Yeah, that's
the,
what I
mean. The petitioner here never really developed that. I mean, they've argued that we did prevail on our claim for rescission. Let me argue, at least from this complaint, they allege damages and rescission. Those are their two claims. The other ones are sort of tack-ons. We want costs, we want fees, we want other unknown equitable relief. We don't have damages. I don't think that this is really a rescission claim, what they're asking for. What they're asking for really was injunctive relief. Rescission would, in my reading of, I looked at some Black's Law Dictionary with this last week, and what does it mean to rescind a contract? That means restoring the parties back to square one, which would mean he would have to return, that being the petitioner, the vehicle to the leasing company, and they'd have to refund all the money that he paid up until that point, in addition to the termination of the contract. I don't think that's not really what happened here, what they were looking for. They were looking for injunctive relief, stop doing this, and potentially damages if one lied for harassment or defamation. And neither of those were pled. Unfortunately, I had much more to say, but my red light is up.
As I understand the argument from your opposing counsel, as long the lease is unenforceable, but as long as it's out there, the consumer has difficulty acquiring a new automobile, new motor vehicle. What's your rebuttal to that, if I have stated it correctly?
Honestly, I don't know that that's the case. That is an argument that was never made or developed in this case. There's nothing in the record that I see that would support that. I would note, too, that there are additional materials attached to the petitioner's reply brief that I think are improperly attached, and one being from the National Consumer Law Center, which is from its About Us page on its website, describes itself as a nonprofit advocacy organization that seeks to build economic security and family wealth for low-income and other economically disadvantaged Americans. That's not something that the court can take judicial notice of. That's an advocacy statement from like-minded individuals to Mr. Killian's attorneys. I don't know. The statute doesn't speak to that. The statute says the lease is unenforceable upon the consumer's receipt of a refund from the manufacturer. That's all it says. Doesn't say that the lessor must do anything else. What else does the lessor do? Mr. Aiken argues that there's information out there that's going to make it more difficult for an individual to get another loan, for example. I don't know if that's the case, but there's nothing under this Lemon Law that says that the lessor must do something in addition, and they've never criticized Mercedes Financial for not doing something more. there's a demand for some letter early on, that, and maybe that was the reason that they filed the lawsuit. Mr. Magna's letters to Mercedes Financial says, you must supply us with a statement that the lease is terminated. Well, the law doesn't say that. The law just tells the lessor that this is now unenforceable against this person. You must look elsewhere as far as what you want to do with the car, what you want to do with the lease. You know, it's unenforceable against Mr. Killian. That's all it says.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Wells. Mr. Magna?
Thank you. A couple quick things here to clear up a few points. In the record, there is a statement from the representative of Mercedes-Benz Financial that Financial is, quote, the financial arm of Mercedes-Benz USA. In the complaint that was filed in this case, paragraph 13 of plaintiff's complaint.
Counselor, are you reading that to us? Because if, rather than having this car financed for the lease by Financial, it had been financed by U.S. Bank. They do car leases. Well, you wouldn't be making the same arguments to us?
Well, the reason I read that, because there was a question posed by one of the justices that was not answered. That's the only reason I'm answering it. In this case, the question was, what is the relationship between the two?
All right. But the relationship between the two, do you think that's relevant under the statute one way or the other?
Well, it would apply to any lessor.
Okay. Your argument doesn't depend on any relationship
Just trying to answer that question.
Okay. I just want to be sure that I understand where you are.
I think they are brother and sister, but they do know what one hand is doing, but the statute applies to any lessor equally.
Okay. All right.
In the plaintiff's complaint, paragraph 13, the plaintiff alleges that despite plaintiff's return of the 2007 Mercedes-Benz, the defendant Mercedes-Benz Financial continues to enforce the motor vehicle lease against the plaintiff in violation of 218.01712CM3. And that paragraph is denied in the answer of Mercedes Financial. On October 1st, in request for admissions, which is in this record, the request was the defendant, Daimler Chrysler Financial Services Americas, LLC, doing business as Mercedes-Benz Financial, continues to enforce the motor vehicle lease agreement for the 2007 Mercedes-Benz leased by the plaintiff against the plaintiff. And that response is also denied. There's a couple of things. We sued under the Lemon Law because the Lemon Law was violated. Why didn't they seek a declaratory judgment? Why didn't they sue under injunction? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Everything that we didn't do, every lawsuit that we did not file, we should have filed, but the one we did file, we shouldn't have. And not only shouldn't we have filed that, but they brought a claim against us that this action was frivolous. They sought attorney's fees from us because it was frivolous. That's the arrogance that we deal with. Attorney Wells did admit, isn't it fair to say that Killian did nothing wrong? Yes. So let's make him pay our fees and let's make this case frivolous because he did nothing wrong.
But doesn't this case have to go back for, should you prevail? This court can't declare damage. It can declare damages, but it can't calculate the damages, right?
Right.
You'd have to go back and do that. Should you prevail on defamation, you've got to go back to the trial court.
We do. We'd have to have a trial on that issue.
That's right. And prove up. And do you expect double damages on that?
On the defamation,
yeah.
Libelous? I honestly don't know. The statute, if it would be considered pecuniary loss, it would be
right.
Doubled.
That's what I'm asking.
But if it were considered damages, it wouldn't have to be doubled.
Okay. Because damages is in the first part of that sentence. Pecuniary loss
yes,
is
there
in
are,
the second part. Okay.
There are damages under the Lemon Law that are not pecuniary loss. And those damages in a lawsuit under the Lemon Law would not be doubled, but you'd still get them.
Counselor, let me redirect you to something that's been kind of bothering me. Opposing counsel says what you really did is filed for an injunction here, that's what you should have done, but you asked for rescission. I think both sides agree, you and opposing counsel, that what you were trying to do was to stop the collection efforts of financial and to give your client something in hand to show that those efforts were stopped. Correct? We have a lot of case law that says we don't care what kind of a label you put on your claim. We're going to look at what the facts are and what people were trying to do. So I'm not altogether sure that we're precluded from saying that what you really did here was to sue for an injunction, regardless of what label you put on it, and that you, in fact, got what you requested, which was a cessation of the collection efforts. If that were our conclusion, then you certainly would be the prevailing party. But I'm not sure where that takes us from here. In other words, if you had brought a claim for an injunction under the Lemon Law and had simply gotten that at the trial court and that was the end of the story, you would be entitled to attorney's fees under the Lemon Law statute for obtaining the injunction, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what you would be left with is, if that were our conclusion, a remand to the trial court to figure out what attorney's fees are owed, period, end of story.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
One other thing that Justice Bradley did mention, and I would like to mention this because it is exactly true, and we did brief this at the appellate court, was to not make the manufacturer pay off the lessor doesn't make any sense. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. Under the Lemon Law, the lessor should be paid off by the manufacturer. And we did practice law that way for 20 years, and it always worked. It's just that in the Tammy case, the Tammy case did was quote two statutes, and they're confusing, as Justice Bradley pointed out. But the Tammy case didn't develop this argument at all. It just quoted that because the Supreme Court was asked to answer other questions, and they just quoted those sections. And then the appellate court quoted those two sections, which don't make any sense. Because if the Lemon Law gets a refund if the consumer gets a refund by surrendering his lemon to the manufacturer, that vehicle still doesn't have to be branded because all of the requirements haven't been met. It isn't enough just to give the refund.
Counsel, the red light's been on for more than a reasonable time.
Okay.
Finish the sentence, please.
The only thing is, I was saying that the Lemon Law, just refunding money to the manufacturer wouldn't mean that vehicle is going to be branded as a lemon because all of the elements of the refund haven't been complied with, so the lessor could take a vehicle back without even branding it as a lemon and put it back in the stream of commerce, as I read the statutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for good arguments in yet another Lemon Law case. And so concludes our hearing in 09 AP 538, Stephen T.
Killian versus Mercedes-Benz USA et al. The court is in recess till 1:30 for our last argument for the day, and Justice Crooks will be out shortly.
I'm going to stay right here.
Justice Crooks is staying right here. So we'll proceed very quickly with a discussion of the court's process.